With all I see on social media and other formats of the millennial generation, it strikes me through seeing various comments and the attitudes that people have that really our greatest fear, I want us to think carefully about this statement, our greatest fear of the new generation, whether it's the one we have now or the one that will come in the future, is not what it's doing and not where it's going to bring us, but it's that we are responsible for it. And I believe that is what is concerning to so many when they think about the actions of the young people, the ones they see coming up, and they're afraid of what might come from various behaviors and various actions. It's not so much those things themselves, but I think in our subconscious, deep down, the real problem is we feel responsible. I think those of us who are parents understand that concept. As we're raising our children, the greatest fear and the greatest joy, the possibility of joy, is the fact that we are, in many ways, responsible for the way they end up. They certainly have their own choice and their own free will, but we know the weight of the impact, just as Jeff talked about this morning in his sermon. And in coordination with some of what Jeff talked about this morning, I want us to look at Judges, the first couple chapters especially, Judges 1 and 2, and think about this process. Think about the way in which Israel functions as they enter the land. And during the life of Joshua, things are very good and things start out very well. But very quickly after Joshua dies and after the elders who are with Joshua die, things begin to go downhill very quickly. And so what we see is the story of Israel really pictured in the first two chapters of the book of Judges. In so many ways, if you were to read this, it's just a massive overview, a big summary of things that are taking place throughout the whole history of Israel, especially during this time period, and it's setting us up for the stories that are to come in the book of Judges. And we'll see some of that here in a minute in what we read as it's introducing the stories that you're going to continue to read throughout the book of Judges. But it's interesting that really it begins in such a good place. We are getting this picture of what things were like after Joshua dies. And things seem pretty good. That's where the book begins. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord. That's a great start. They're inquiring of the Lord. They want to know what the Lord thinks about their actions to come. And so it says, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? They're following after the pattern of Joshua. And for the first 20 verses or so, things go very, very well. They begin going into these areas and dominating people. In fact, we have this story at the very beginning that's extremely interesting. Adonibezek, who they cut off his thumbs and his big toes, and he's done this to so many others. This is the will of God coming back on him, he assumes. The kind of story that kids love to read about. And think about this man stumbling around and the justice of God coming upon him. And so the story begins so well in the book of Judges until you come to verse 21. And in verse 21, the people here now transition from really following the will of God, from inquiring on the will of God, to now people who begin to kind of alter God's vision. They begin to play with a little bit what God wants for them. He has told them to drive out the Canaanites, to get rid of these people out of the land, to completely annihilate them, some of them to devote to destruction, destroy the city, destroy everything that lives, and it is a dedication to God, and God wants them to drive all of these people out. And so for a while that seems to happen, but you come to verse 21, but the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. Maybe it was a challenging city. Certainly it would have been on a hill with the walls around it. It presents some difficulty, not unlike some of the various other difficulties that others would have faced before them. But for whatever reason, they do not drive the people out. But you notice what happens, much like what Jeff talked about this morning with the picture of Abraham and his lying. Now the verses flow. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean. Ephraim did not drive out. Zebulun did not drive out. Asher did not drive out. Naphtali did not drive out. And the inhabitants of all these various cities now are joining in among the people of God. So they've altered God's vision for them. And I imagine in their time, they didn't think too deeply about some of what they're doing, because it's not as if they didn't drive these people out and they befriended them and became close to them, and now everything was good and they were tight. You know, they did things together. They went on vacation together and all that. That's not how this worked. No, they were subject to labor. You know, God, your plan's really good, but what if we take these people and we make them our servants? You know, we don't have to do as much work. We can have them fortifying our cities and building things up for us. This seems like such a great plan. This would be great. You know, we're not killing all of them. We're not driving them out of the land. We're not forcing them to leave, but we're forcing them into labor. They're subjecting them to forced labor, it says in verse 35. So they've changed the vision of God to some extent. But then what ultimately happens as we progress in the story is that God is ultimately forsaken. They begin by losing sight of God's vision, and then their children lose sight of God altogether. Quite a scary text for those of us who feel the burden of responsibility with our own children, or maybe even as a group, we feel the burden of responsibility for the children, for the youth, and what they're experiencing and what they're going to become, and thinking about this fear of the responsibility of what's happening with this generation that's going to arise. And that's where I want us to begin reading tonight in the book of Judges in chapter 2. They bury Joshua. He's dead and gone, and all the elders that are with him, they're dead and gone. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. Verse 10. Verse 11, it says, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. This phrase will continue to surface repeatedly in the book of Judges. It begins here. This new generation arises. And they have been affected by what's come before them. And now they do what's evil in the sight of the Lord, and they abandon the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who are around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Asheroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them. And they were in terrible distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices of their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. The people of Joshua's day were not perfect in this. They were to blame in some extent. They began leaving people there, and that's the condemnation we find in the first part of chapter 2. Like I said, almost every section of chapters 1 and 2 are summaries of everything that's to come in the book, explaining why we're going to read these stories of the judges. And so chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, is no different. It says, now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. All of these contrasts that we're finding here in the opening chapters of the book of Judges. I brought you out of the land of Egypt, and I brought you to the land I swore to give to your fathers. I am a covenant God, he says. I have been faithful to my covenant, and I asked you to make no covenants with the people. And of course, what happens at the end of chapter 1 is they make covenant after covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they make them laborers rather than driving them out. And so they did not obey their voice of the Lord. And as a result, we see this as an influence on the generation that was to come. So what happened in this whole process? I mean, why is it that we have these people? Yes, they made some mistakes, but here they sacrifice to the Lord and they rededicate themselves to him, and they're faithful all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders, and yet still a generation arises that does not know God and does not know the works that he had done for Israel. When I read this, it was puzzling to me. How did they not know the works that he had done for Israel? He brought them out of the land of Egypt. I mean, this is part of their heritage, part of the history of Israel. He had brought them out of slavery, as he mentions here at the beginning of chapter 2, and so many miraculous things happen on the way, and they come into the land, and Joshua and the people, they defeat all these nations and kings, that sometimes in insurmountable odds, it seemed, and yet God still brings them victory, and so they're aware of this, and they know this. How is it that this next generation has no knowledge of God, and they don't understand the works that God had done for them? Well, the more I thought about it, the more I realized the answer's right here in the text. What this generation saw was failure. And the generation before them, they had failings just like any generation, but they had returned to God. They had seen, many of them, with their own eyes, the things that happened, the crossing of Jordan, and various other things that God had done for them. And so despite some of the problems they had and the sins that they had in their life, they ultimately came back, and again, they rededicated themselves. But what happens with their children is their children don't experience this because the wrath of God is coming upon them because of their disobedience. And he says, I'm no longer going to drive these people out. They're going to remain here as a snare for you to test you. And so their children, what they see is Benjamin did not drive out, and Manasseh did not drive out, and Ephraim did not drive out, and Zebulun did not drive out, and Asher did not drive out, and Naphtali did not drive out. That's what the next generation saw. They didn't witness the works that the Lord God had done for Israel, because the Lord ultimately, as he tends to do with those who defy him, gave the people what they wanted. They didn't want to go in and drive these people out, and so then he said, well, you can just live with them. And rather than experiencing the great works that their fathers had seen, and the fathers before them, now they were not witness to the power of God working among these people. Did you notice that statement? That every time they went out, God was not with them. That's a pretty powerful statement when we consider how they've gotten where they are now. Sihon, king of Og, they come in, he won't let them go through the land, and so they just wipe him out. They come into Jericho, and they march around the city a bunch of times, and the walls just fall down, and they go in and conquer the people by the power of God, and yet now we're to a point with this generation where God does not go out with them anymore. Where they go to fight their battles, and rather than seeing success, there is failure after failure after failure. And some of this ties in a big way to what we talked about this morning with the influence and the impact of some of the decisions that we make. And one of the things I want us to think about and emphasize tonight, and something like what we're doing this evening, and some of you young people who are here and you came with your parents, is realizing the types of decisions that they're trying to make in order to influence you in the right way. They could have chosen to not be here tonight, to not bring you tonight, to not be this example tonight, but they want to do the opposite of the sorts of things that are happening in a text like this. They want you to see, not because they have to come and be here tonight, because they want to come and they want to be here tonight, because they want to honor God, and they want to show respect and honor to him. They want to glorify him in their life. They want the influence of God's people. They want to be built up and they want to be encouraged. It's not because of some ritual or some mandatory thing that has to be done, but they realize the impact that these types of decisions have long term, and they realize sometimes what we have to overcome in some of the decisions that we made. And so we try to make the best decisions possible. We are not perfect. And whether it's my kids or whether it's your kids, I hope our young people understand that we get that. We look back at these stories of the Israelites and we think, man, we wouldn't be like that. And maybe we wouldn't have been sometimes. But the reality is we're human. And sometimes we doubt. And sometimes we lack faith. Sometimes we need encouragement, which is why we gather at a place like this. And sometimes we fail. Sometimes the failures are large. And that's what we see here at Bochim when Israel is rebuked by the Lord. And he says, you did not obey my voice. I told you not to make covenants with the people. And yet you changed my vision. You altered my plans. And you did things in your own way. And now you're going to see the results of that. You're going to see the fruit of that. And the sad reality is what happens here with Israel, though they repent, though they're penitent for some of their actions, things are already in motion. The results are already beginning to happen with their own children. They must be to get to this statement in chapter 2 that there's another generation that arose that did not know the Lord. So I want us to think about those of us who have children, who have young people, the importance of not just big decisions that we make, but the day-to-day decisions. The little things that our young people witness in our lives. I don't know if you're like me, you probably are. This is one of those things that I think as a parent you think about a lot. But if you're also like me, it's sometimes hard to change the behaviors, to change the habits. We could probably make a list of things in our daily activities that we know 100% certain would be the right types of things for our children to be seeing that we're doing. Waking up in the morning and reading the Bibles. They come downstairs or they come out of their bedroom and they see us there sitting at the kitchen table reading our Bible or praying and meditating and doing all these things that we know, if we're writing this all down on paper, that's the sorts of things that we want our children to be witness of. And yet we struggle to enact them sometimes, don't we? Or at least I do. It takes considerable effort, as simple as that may seem. It takes a lot of thought. It takes a lot of effort to try to change some of our behaviors and think about the importance, not just for my own life, but for the impact of those who are around me, our spouses as well, the impact that we have when we do these sorts of activities, whether it's praying or reading, and then the public nature of those kinds of things, where our children and our spouse, they're aware of that and they're encouraged. It's lowering that threshold that Jeff talked about in the right direction. What a wonderful thing to set out to do. To make it a simple thing, to make it an easy thing for someone to sit down on the couch or sit down at the table and open their Bible and read it because they see others doing the same thing. So we have to try to find ways to build these types of behaviors into our day-to-day activities. And wouldn't it be interesting if God actually told us the importance of doing that? He did in Deuteronomy chapter 6. That's exactly what he told the Israelites. When you walk by the way, when you lie down, all the things that you do, you find opportunity to point your children to the Lord. But we know it's easy to get busy and to be pulled in 100 different directions and to think, I'll do that tomorrow. And we're so focused on the short term that we're missing the long-term picture. And maybe that's what happens here with the Israelites. We have so much to do. We're trying to rebuild cities, and we have all these responsibilities we're trying to fit into a day. Let's just take some of these Canaanites. We'll make them forced laborers. That's going to help us. I don't know if that's what they said, but it would make a lot of sense. And so they're thinking about the right now. They're thinking short term, but what they're not thinking about is what happens in chapter 3. In chapter 3, the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites that all live among them, their daughters they took to themselves for wives. And their own daughters they gave to their sons. And they served their gods. the long-term impact of assimilating with the world around them was not considered. In whatever short-term scenario they had constructed in their mind as they revamped the vision of God for them. God told them to drive out. He said, they will be a snare for you. He even told them, it's that thing written down on paper. Israel, if you keep these people here, they're going to be a snare for you. You know that intellectually. Let's make some plans to let that not happen. And yet they decide, God's vision's pretty nice, but I think I'm going to enact my own vision for what I want. Let's do things maybe in our own ways. And so they begin to use bad methods. And they don't understand what God wants from them. They begin to do things in their own ways, in their own methods, which end up with terrible results in the end as we get to the middle part of chapter 2, and especially as we get to chapter 3, where now they're intermarrying with the people. And not only are they intermarrying with the people, now they're bowing down. And there is supposed to be some physical imagery there of what's happening. They're getting down on their knees and they're bowing down to these other gods. That's how far it's gone. So as I was reading through this, my thought is, what kinds of things may I be doing that are influencing my children to be assimilated into the world that may eventually cause them to be the ones who are bowing down to the gods of the world, to the various activities and things that happen in the world, the temporal world that does not matter, the world that is deceiving and that is confusing? What kind of things am I doing that are causing my children to then go in that direction? This is a lesson that's not just about the Israelites. It's about all of us as parents, all of us as the older generation that's influencing the younger generation. And sometimes we're so hard about the millennials or about whatever the new generation is at the time, but the reality is, we are concerned and we're afraid that we're responsible for what's happening. And rather than admit the responsibility, rather than taking the duty for what is happening, we begin to throw it off on other things. And Jeff brought up the shootings and all of that today. So we have all these arguments. We know, well, we need to have better gun laws, and we need to have metal detectors, and we need to have all these sorts of things. Listen, the problem is people, and the problem is a generation that is responsible for another generation that has arose that does not know God. That's the problem. And rather than take responsibility for that and begin to try to change it, we begin to cast the blame in other directions and think that some other solution is out there that will save face for those of us who are older. Israel is an example in Scripture of the travesty that happens when poor decisions are made. When they allow their children to see failure rather than success because of the lack of faith they have in God and the decisions they make. And they allow their children, and they even push their children because of some of their behaviors, to join the world, to assimilate into the world. Have we not seen those kind of things in real time in our world? I have seen with my own eyes, and I'm sure some of you have as well, how important it is for some parents that their child is popular. That is this story right here. That is pushing them into the world. That is losing sight of what is important long term. That is allowing them to marry their daughters and give your daughters to their men. That is that whole picture, that whole scenario, because what is most important in that idea is the praise of man rather than the praise of God. And it's a losing of sight of what is most important. And so maybe these are small changes. Maybe it's just altering the vision just a little bit. And this sort of thing happens with things like worship or things like what the church purpose is, what our mission is as God's people. It begins to be altered just a little. You know, wouldn't God want us to do all these other things that we think are good rather than just sticking to what he has actually told us to do? And that is us altering the vision of God for ourselves. And we think, how could that be a problem? How could that cause issues in the future? And what we have seen from a sociological standpoint, since we talked some about that this morning, is so many of those things are failures in society. And our children look at that and think, that doesn't work. And so then they abandon altogether. The purpose of the church, at least from what Paul has to say in Ephesians chapter 3, is that they proclaim the manifold wisdom of God. They make it known to the world. If we continue on a little bit, the purpose, the work of the church is to equip the saints for the work of service, for the work of ministry. If we look further on in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, it is to encourage this mutual edification, the encouraging and the building up of one another. It is to glorify God. It is not the innumerable other things that people think church is. And as good as some of those things might be, and as good as maybe some of the intentions are for whatever other activities people try to then wrap up in the work of the church, the reality is that is altering the vision of God for what his people are. I'm sure that Israel thought it was a great idea to do what they did. But the end result is exactly what the angel reveals to them. These people are a snare to them. Their great plan and their grand vision for how they were going to reconstruct their cities and become prosperous and successful in the promised land was something that was actually going to lead to their ultimate destruction, although it would be hundreds of years in the future. What the writer of Judges wants us to see is the repetition of this action. He wants us to see the downfall, generation to generation to generation. At times, they come back and they try to do what's right, but then they fall again. And the influence of all previous activity, it has bared such a weight upon these people that they continually return to the Baals under the Ashtaroths. And so that is the story of Judges, in summary. A people with great opportunity. A people that were given so much, and yet did so little in return. We can look to a New Testament passage to give us some insight about how some of this works. These Israelites did not set out or intend, I believe, to become close with these people and the foreign nations around them, but in fact they did. For whatever reason, it became important to them, begin to intermarry, and they begin to worship their gods. And this was what James says, friendship with the world is enmity with God. The person who wants to be a friend with the world, he makes himself an enemy with God, James says. Pretty straightforward. If our desire is to be popular in the world, to have success in the world, to have big friends and important friends and powerful friends in the world, to have the right network and to connect to all the people in the world, that's really what we're after. We're going to have a pretty hard time being a friend of God. That's going to present some big difficulties for us. I think James, in essence, is a lot like Proverbs, speaking general principles. And so maybe you can say, well, I have got big friends in the world. I know people who are powerful, and yet I'm desiring to do the will of God. That's fine. I understand that can happen. What he's speaking here is in a general way, or if we're thinking about where our heart truly is, if our heart is in the world, we are not a friend to God. If we're going to alter God's vision, then we're not really obeying the will of God. We're not following his commandments. We're doing the things that we want to do. And as we looked at this morning, as we've been looking at in Judges, what happens with that is our children, the next generation, they pick up on that. And through the failures and their misguided idea of what God actually is, then they begin to abandon God. But the story of Judges, like so many other stories in the Bible, doesn't end there. Praise be to God. It actually ends with another statement, in essence, that James makes, and that is that God gives more grace. As I was reading through Judges, I've been reading through the book of Judges for a few days now in my just reading of text. I've been trying to get in the better habit of reading every day, reading every morning. And then a while back now, I guess it really was, I began reading Judges. And this verse stuck out to me as I was reading. I see the disaster of what Israel is in the book of Judges, what they've become. A few things stick out in this text as we get to verse 16 and following. The Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. As unfaithful and as unthankful as these people were, God over and over again raises up judges to deliver them. He finds a way, he has a plan to try to bring them back from this terrible distress, verse 15. Here's where it brings them. right? They have their own ideas and they have their own vision and they want to go their own way. And then ultimately they just forsake God altogether and they begin to worship the Baals. And it will come a point when God will say, if you want Baal so much, you go see if he can deliver you. It's kind of that reshaping and reforming that he ultimately wants to do as he's going to bring back the remnant. But right here, what he's doing is, in their terrible distress, when they cry out to him over and over and over again, this is the story of Judges, he sends someone to save them. And notice even the terminology in chapter 3. Israel cried out to the Lord. The Lord raised up a deliverer. He is the God of deliverance. He's the God of redemption. He's the God of reconciliation. Despite all the evil things these people had done, when they cried out to him, he raised up a deliverer for them. But the terminology goes even beyond that. Verse 18, whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groanings because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. He is a God who hears. He is a God who cares. He is a God who saves and delivers. And while the reality of what we already talked about, of the responsibility, falls on our shoulders as we look to our children and we look to the next generation and we are concerned, we are even afraid of what that's going to look like, God does not leave us without hope. Our young people really need to listen. We already talked about the reality of our failures, and what we need is you to be as gracious as God is to us, as merciful, putting on the image of Christ, putting on the nature of the divine giver, to see through the mistakes and see through the faults and see through the problems that we've created, and whatever it is that we've done, to still love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and your strength. Because the alternative is blaming the previous generation and arising as a generation that does not know God, that does not know and not aware, does not recognize the works that the Lord has done for you. And where you will find yourself is exactly where Israel found itself, in terrible distress. God doesn't leave us without hope if we'll listen. If we'll just turn and come back to him, he gives more grace. That's what he wants to do. The idea that God is out there just wanting to condemn us, that he's just waiting for the right moment when we sin or we do something wrong to condemn us eternally in hell is not what the Bible teaches. Think about the horrific stories in the book of Judges. How vile and how evil some of these people are, and yet God gives more grace. He sends judge after judge after judge, trying to win their hearts back to him. And maybe you're sitting there tonight thinking about the horrible things you've done in your life. Maybe the impact of what we've talked about tonight is hitting you as you think about the responsibility you believe you bear for the generation that's come after you, whether it's your children or whether it's just others that you have been around and you think, we are responsible for this, or I am responsible because of some of my actions. And that very well may be true, but we can't leave tonight without realizing that God gives more grace. He wants you. And the way to begin to repair that is to give your life to God. For all those around you, whether it's people in this building or those who are without, that you can testify that you've done this to, what they really need to see is that you're going to come back to the Lord. You're going to do things in his ways. You're no longer going to operate with your own vision, altering the vision of God, but now you want to come back to him and fall at his feet and bow down before him rather than bowing before the world. And more than that, you want to be a testimony to all those around you that they need to do the same thing. It's completely unnecessary for someone to come down to the front. We offer that. But it's not what anybody has to do. But I will say this. When you come down to the front and you bow on your feet and your knees and you profess that Jesus Christ is Lord and you're going to give your life to him, there are witnesses all around you seeing you do that. And the impact of that may be something that we never, ever fully understand. That we will confess with our mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord. And that we need him as our deliverer Will you do that tonight? Why don't you come now as we stand and we sing together?